Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. That's Chuck Brown. If we're ever honoring him and some other musicians today, this is his birthday. We're about to talk to Dr. Shibli Talhami, Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland College Park, a senior fellow at the Sabin Center at the Brookings Institution, author of The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace, and his latest book, The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and Reshaping the Middle East. And Dr. Talhami, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be with you.
Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com or log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Shibli, I've been really enjoying your book, and we look forward to having you back on for a longer session to talk about your book, which I think is important.
Appreciate it.
But I do want to kind of probe with you Syria and Egypt today, and you spent all this time kind of looking at polling people and kind of looking deeply into the psyche of the mind of people, the social mind of people in the Arab world. And I just, you know, when you look at what's going on in Syria and you look at what's going on in Egypt, and I saw some of the things you were writing about how the kind of the people have been deeply moved in the Arab world by their by being Muslim, even if they're not fundamentalists, even if they're not people who are just deep into the Quran, that there's something happening in the psyche of people that is changing the mood of the entire Middle East, that that's part of what's at foot here in the turmoil that we're seeing?
Well, you know, I think one of the points that I make, particularly with regard to Egypt, but really across the Arab world, is that when you look at how the Middle East has been transformed, not just simply through the last couple of years with the uprisings, but in terms of how it has changed over the past decade or more, there has been some very clear transformation of identity, and in some ways, it's been misunderstood. I think when we look at what transpired, particularly with the advent of the information revolution and particularly satellite television in the mid-90s, we see that across the board, there has been a decline in people's identification with the state. There are many reasons for that, obviously. Some of it is just the failure of the states to provide. Some of it is the longevity of rulers, and people couldn't really differentiate between ruler and state. But regardless, a lot of it took place. Some of it, by the way, is also connected to this new media, which is by definition transnational, is catering to broader Arabs and Muslims, not to the local Arabs, and therefore also intensified this what I call transnational media, transnational identity, particularly Arab and Muslim, but especially Muslim. And so when a lot of people looked at the past decade, they said there has been a very pronounced rise in Islamic identity in the Arab world. No question, this has been sort of noted. I'm not the only one who noted that over the past decade. But I really do think this was misunderstood, and I think it was also misunderstood by Islamists and particularly by the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, to think that people really just embraced their agenda. They didn't. Because I think what moves people in the first place is a set of aspirations, and they jump on whatever vehicle they think is going to get them there. In part, this rise in Islamic identity was a function of the decline of the state identity, but in part, it was that a lot of people felt that Muslims were under assault, that Islam was under assault from the West, particularly after 9/11, and you are what you have to defend. Whatever identity is under assault, you rally behind it. So in the end, I think what happened in Egypt, particularly with the Brotherhood, which was very well organized, got to power, it never really got a majority of the public. I think it overplayed its hands, and it couldn't deliver. And people reacted. And I fear that the military may be also overreacting and just thinking that they're being embraced by the Egyptian public, when in fact, I think for now, it's a rejection of the Brotherhood that might turn against them. We've seen that right after the first Egyptian revolution in 2011, when the military was very popular after the overthrow of Mubarak. And by May 2012, the elections, only 18% thought the military were actually advancing the interests of the Egyptian revolution.
So, Shibli, I wonder then what you... How would you make a what would be your broad analysis of what we're seeing in a historical context in the Arab world now between Syria? I mean, everywhere we look, Syria, Iraq.
Well, there are two things. Yes, I understand. And let me just tell you two things that I see that we have to understand. The first thing is you ask, what is really profoundly new in all these? We've seen, you know, uprisings in the Arab world, but we've seen them before. We've seen them in other places. What's new about these uprisings? I think if you ask me that, I would tell you that the fundamental factor that is different from before is the empowerment of the individual, the end of fear. People prepared to take risks. People prepared to pay a price for what they want. People's expectations have risen. And much of that has to do with the information revolution, something that is expanding, it's not going back. So we see incredible empowerment on a scale that we had never seen before. That empowerment, of course, means that not all, you know, when we say everybody is empowered, it means left and right is empowered. Religious and secular is empowered. It means different ethnic groups are empowered. So empowerment doesn't entail that you have a situation of equilibrium or that you have no conflict. In fact, it increases conflict. And the more homogeneous society is, the less conflict there is, but the more heterogeneous it is, the more conflict there is. I think that's what we're seeing in Syria. Beyond, you know, the obvious, what you see in particularly in, across ethnic groups, across sex, we see an empowerment. People are prepared to pay a price. Look, I mean, if the numbers are right, we have over 100,000 dead already right. in Syria, and people are still going. That is incredible. This is unprecedented in the Arab world, and I think that's something that also we should think about pertaining to Egypt, which is that if the military thinks that they can just simply impose order through violence without some people at some point taking risks to take them on, I just don't think it's going to happen. But the second thing that's going on is fear. And that's something I warn about particularly in my book. That is that despite all of this empowerment and the fact that you had places like Egypt and Tunisia where initially these revolutions were peaceful, when you have extended anarchy or you had fear that your identity is under attack, that's when people go backward. For a while, they rally behind. We've seen that obviously in the rise of many authoritarian rules in the past to capitalize on anarchy. We see a little bit of that, I think, in Egypt. And there is fear, even in Syria, you can argue that in some ways some people ended up rallying behind the regime because of the fear of the jihadists that were rising. So that fear, obviously, propels people to rally behind those who can promise more order in the short term. But I think it's no going back, in my opinion. I think this is going to be progressive change, but it is going to have a lot of steps back, and I think we're seeing some now.
And I think when you come back, I do want to explore deeply this whole notion of the heterogeneity of the Arab world, because I think that most people in the West don't understand that at all. The Arab world, whether we're talking the ethnic differences between Berbers and Arabs on the coast, or whether we're talking about Christians, Muslims, Jews, Druze, or Zoroastrians, the complexity of the Arab world, I think the West does not get at all.
And yes, and even in places that seemingly are heterogeneous ethnically, like in Egypt, and look at that incredible division among secularists and religious forces. And even within the religious groups, recall the Muslim Brotherhood really has been in some ways abandoned by the other most powerful Islamist group, the part of the Salafi movement, the Nur Party. that got nearly about a quarter of the seats in the parliament. So it's really far more complicated than people assume, and lumping people together really doesn't help.
So is there, from your perspective, in the few minutes we have, in the 5 or 6 minutes we have left, is there a response the West should have? You saw the headlines just a few minutes ago in the New York Times that France says that there should be like a Libyan-like response by the West. In other words, Western air forces going into Syria if there is, in fact, chemical weapons used, or how people are kind of confused about should they cut off all aid to the Egyptian military? I mean, it seems like nobody really knows what the response should be.
Well, I think particularly in Syria, in Egypt, obviously nobody is going to say let's intervene militarily.
The question is,
in part, it's about capabilities and other things. Really about Syria, and Syria is a heartbreak because I think realistically, when you see maybe if there was an intervention possibility, it was before. But when they say like Libya, it's silly because Libya, recall, had the support of, at least formally in the UN Security Council, it had the support of Russia and China, that the international community managed to get their support. Obviously, Russia and China ultimately thought that they went beyond the mandate, that NATO particularly went beyond the mandate, and that's one reason they're actually reluctant to do anything pertaining to Syria. But there is no indication that Russia is going to go along. If anything, Russia will fight it, and they're making a case of it. And so the implications, even beyond what we can do on the ground, are we saying that we're going to, we're going to do it even if the Russians and the Chinese are going to oppose it, even if we don't have a UN resolution supporting it, and the Russians actually end up, going into a confrontational posture. I don't think that's going to happen. I certainly don't think this administration is going to do it. Partly, I think that I don't personally see an outside resolution. I am torn on Syria. I see the humanitarian disaster. I think it's a failure of the international system for sure. But I am not sure that there is a real military solution at this point. I think certainly from the outside, it's very difficult to imagine.
And this finally, in the last few minutes, we have Dr. Shabir Talhami. Another part of this divide has to do with this kind of the differences I've seen in the Arab world between people who really embrace the fundamentally Islam and those who are more moderately Islamists and who are more secular. This is a divide. This is a conflict within almost every Arab country I could name.
I'll tell you, I always happen to believe that if you think about the Arab-Israeli conflict, if it weren't there, the real divide that you will see in surrounding countries as well as in Israel itself,
yes,
is a secular religious divide.
Absolutely.
That is really what's going on, and that has become so intense in part because these groups use the polarization and the fact that the elites and the secular elites usually are focused on other issues. They use them to intensify their own support locally, and they use the nationalism and the religious nationalism symbols in the context of the conflict. And so, yes, I think you're absolutely right. And that is not only true of what's happening in Egypt and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon, but even obviously we can see it among the Palestinians, particularly the Hamas-Fatah divide isn't just a leadership divide. It's really a religious secular divide. And if you look at the Israeli elections, the recent ones, you find that the basic, a principle that brought the ruling coalition together was a way to marginalize some of the religious groups and their hold or certain aspects of power within Israeli society. And if you have some political settlement, I think you're going to see more of that.
And I think I'm glad you put Israel into the mix, because they are as divided in the same way as the Arab nations, and we don't want to recognize that often in the West and in America. Dr. Shabir Talhami, it's always a pleasure and honor to have you with us. We look forward to soon in the next couple of weeks having you back on for a much longer conversation just about your book, which I really want to explore with you in some depth.
Love to be back.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
We've been talking to Dr. Shabir Talhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland College Park. His latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Don Rojas talking about this new conference coming up tonight for the Institute of the Black World. Stay with us.
Art, beats, and lyrics, and you get Strictly Hip Hop. The tradition continues. My name is Florida, and I'm here to tell you about Strictly Hip Hop, which comes on each and every Friday night at midnight on 88.9 FM. You can hear your favorite DJs along with interviews from your favorite artists. That's midnight on 88.9 FM, WEAA.org, the voice of the community.